this damn microphone.
Just don't fiddle with it.
I won't fiddle with it. Alright. All right. I'm being recorded.
Well, then enough, you are. Sorry, I have your paper. I'm going to give them back. Yeah.
Pass those out.
Right now.
Can you pass these down?
I just been fighting with the main office to get these Xeroxes.
Should I pause me? Is there a pause? Or?
No, because we can edit it up.
Well, I'm not going to say anything then. I'm just going to... I'm not going to... Here we go. Everything I'm saying is being recorded. Don't look at it. Don't look at it yet, though. I'll be out of material.
So my class average is 77.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I'll find out mine tonight.
But I guess Nicole's going to talk to him about,
Have to write your paper again.
Random violence. Here. This was a crazy, impossible assignment, and but it kind of worked. But it helped me to find the theme for the seminar. A little late, you say, but why not? This is a seminar we're supposed to be thinking. And it occurred to me that the answer to the problem, it occurred to me when I was thinking about the two lectures we heard on the medieval day when we went over there. And both historians were using new historicist approaches. Remember I was talking about that? Mm-hmm. They were straight Stephen Greenblatt. So my thesis for the seminar is you read comparative literature because it helps you. You have to read literature. It's more than just one. You have to read literature in order to understand the world. Okay? Greenblatt reads Shakespeare's plays, develops a theory of history, and then all the historians go out and rewrite history. But they're using his theory. Okay. So what I did was, and I was thinking about the Lewis, and most of you are having, only a couple of you really tried to take an idea from Lewis like myth and then apply it. The rest of you sort of bounced around. We had things, but they were all interesting approaches, but they had a common denominator that you were trying to locate this literature in the world, right? So I pulled another Greenblatt work off my shelf, right? And it's the book he wrote on Christopher Columbus. It's called Marvelous Possessions. It came out in 1492, and that's the chapter you have for next week. And he is there reading Christopher Columbus's account of the discovery of America. Have any of you read this chapter? Heard of it? All right. This is the top guy, right? This is Greenblatt himself when he's in his prime, He's written the great book on the Renaissance. He's written the great book on Shakespeare. It's influencing all the historians. And he turned to write about Christopher Columbus. And at the time, of course, everybody wanted to condemn Christopher Columbus for being such a mean man when he came over and enslaved and killed all the Indians. And in his youth, Greenblatt would have no problem with that. But what he wrote was a defense of Columbus. So he just, everybody hated the book, right? Hated the book. Got bad reviews in the New York Times and everything else, and nobody reads it. But it's a brilliant book. It's a brilliant book. And I vow to you that there are critical approaches. We didn't, you know, I thought we should do the whole book, but one chapter will suffice for the seminar. So I Xeroxed it, and we will look at how he handles Columbus's language. Now, this is not the kind of thing I like. It's straight up kind of theory. He's not dealing with a literary text. But this fits our, this seminar, we, you know, you have this feeling you can't analyze text for character or fate anymore. It's all sort of been done. Everybody's looking for new approaches, whether it's boundaries or the divine, or that's what Jason did, and we did a nice thing on boundaries. So, you know, Ed did closure, did sort of an old-fashioned thing. And this will give us another approach, but I think that the thesis here is he can read Columbus and he can read history because he was so astute at reading Shakespeare and literary texts. So there's no doubt he's the great reader. The problem is, of course, nobody believed him when he spoke about Columbus. That's perfect. Right, that's right up there with our St. Matthew and everything else. And in the literary, in the comparative literature world, where Spanish really does dominate the profession of comparative literature, this is the sort of ugly duckling text. So it's perfect, because nobody else is doing it. And you'll see how, we'll take a look at it, at how he, at the kind of arguments he makes. And I would suspect that these are applicable to almost any comparative literature text, and that nobody else is doing it. Right? But they're actually pretty basic. Yeah.
Could you mention the book's title again?
Oh, the book's title. It's called Marvelous Possessions,
which is
the title of it. You know, I didn't even, I think it's also the name of the chapter, or he didn't name the chapter. There's some very daring moves in this chapter, and I want you to look especially, because the only comment I have on your papers, which I rattled, I said to a number of you, is the only comment I ever make on papers. I'm an old freshman composition teacher. I have to have a clear thesis statement. I'm too stupid to follow things otherwise. I like topic sentences, okay, because it makes things easy to follow. And Greenblatt is as smart as they come, and we will spend some time looking at how he writes too. So we'll look at what he says and how he says it. Now, most of you are doing this, but it will reinforce you, I think, in your good habits. Right? I always say the more complicated the idea, the simpler the structure.
Yeah.
And his idea is incredibly complicated, and his structure is crystal clear. And you've got, the only cop I had was mine, so it's got my notes on it. You can even see my three-part outline there at the beginning, so I'm not trying to hide anything here. We're trying to just see how he handles this text, all right? So again, the thesis is, by reading literature, you will be able to actually read the world. And the corollary is, without literature, you can't read the world, because you mistake reality for reality. Okay. And anyway, I think that's a pretty cool way to do it. This will be a good setup for the 100 Years of Solitude, which is sort of looking at things from the other. I think it might even explain magical realism, so that'll be good. And I'm sure it'll do wonders for James Ellroy if those books ever come in. All right? So I was kind of excited about that. I am, if you go on to my website, you can get, I'm sort of writing the syllabus as we move through the class, okay, and it'll be posted. If you click on, if you get to my homepage with my picture of my dog, there's, and you click on courses, you can then click on English 660 in the list, and the syllabus will pop up. Right now, it's just this one that we had a couple of weeks ago, and there'll be an update in a few days. And I've got this internet thing working, and you'll be able to click on, like, today and listen to Ed again. Okay. Right? But Liang is going to edit the tape before you get it, so it won't
be edit me out. As
long. You don't even know this yet, but you need to see me. Okay. But I finally figured out how to edit the tape on a PC, so we don't have all the long pauses and stuff like that. All right, I think that's, in general, I think with an impossible assignment, I really did make it very open-ended, and I wasn't even that clear whether exactly how you were supposed to answer, but I think it gets you thinking. I hope it gets you looking for something. I sat down with the Norton Anthology of Theory and Criticism and tried to figure out, looked at the essays everybody should read, and just as it struck me, is that everything's 20 years old. I mean, the Freud essay has been done. Everything, and the Laura Mulvey on women and the gays and movies. I thought that's the classic. But you know that that volume exists. You know these critical essays, and we don't have time to do everything. I thought this would be better because I don't think anybody's doing it. And you may hate it, but that's. But that's good too. Okay. Well, I don't think so. The guy writes too.
That's the.
Clearly, yeah, the Greenblatt essay in Marvelous Possession. So we'll get through that and then, wait for the next one. I think. But we are, getting towards the end. So that'll give you some shape to this seminar on the problem of comparative literature, right? And. The big problem, one problem being everybody in comparative literature hated this book. It's a good book. All right, that's it.
Okie doke.
Julius Caesar.
Did everybody get a handout? Everybody's got one? What I've done here, the handout, is actually something I sort of based off Dr. Ross's activity of going through each scene and isolating one action from each scene. I didn't get it right on every scene. Sometimes I couldn't help but write a little more.
Did I publish these somewhere?
No, this is my work.
Okay.
No, I came up with it all. It was the idea to do it that I borrowed. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go through every scene with you guys and talk about just stuff that I found interesting in every scene. And hopefully that'll give you insight to the whole thing. And then after that, I'll talk about a few things that are sort of generally interesting about the play. And then after that, I will talk about criticism through the years of Julius Caesar. So let's jump right in. I start Act 1, obviously. I have the summary of Act 1. Though the plebeians are fond of Julius Caesar, the noblemen detest him to the extent that several of them are conspiring against him. Cassius leads the conspiracy. So that's Act 1. Act 1, Scene 1. Marellus and Flavius drive the people off the streets with the hopes of bringing Julius Caesar's ego down a peg. It's really, a lot of times Shakespeare will begin his plays with none of the main characters and something that has nothing to do with the big story. Well, not nothing to do, but it isn't the big story. Hamlet starts out with just a bunch of the lookout people. None of the main characters are in there. And he does that a lot. And we'll talk about that a little later in the criticism. One of our critics has something to say about that. The main interesting thing I found about Act 1, Scene 1, and if anybody has any response or questions, just kind of butt right in. I'm interested in what everybody has to say. This is just kind of some Shakespeare 101. The noblemen in Scene 1 speak in blank verse, and the plebeians speak in prose. Does anyone not know the difference between prose and blank verse? I can say it. Okay. Basically, you'll see the noblemen speak very poetically, and it's in iambic pentameter. You've got at line 15. In Act 1, Scene 1, what trade thou knave, thou naughty knave, what trade? Da 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 da. And then you've got you know, the cobbler here at line 21. And you see, like, there's no rhythm to it per se. There's no sort of a hard poetry to it. It's called prose. It's not. And so the reason Shakespeare always does that, and he's very interested in class in all of his plays. And what you've got here is you've got the nobleman speaking in heightened poetry, and you've got the sort of commoner speaking sort of a raw English. And he'll do that a lot. And there's actually a higher level, which is called, this nobleman is speaking blank verse. There's also rhymed verse. And I don't even think Caesar speaks in rhymed verse in this play. So you don't get a lot of rhymed verse, except for some specific moments that we'll actually talk about. So that's really the big interesting thing I found about Act 1, Scene 1, is that you have the different speaking styles here. Moving on, unless anybody... If you want to kind of come in, you can come in. Act 1, Scene 2. Cassius engages Brutus's interest in the topic of Julius Caesar's godlike celebrity in hopes of persuading Brutus to join the conspiracy. Okay, this is a very long scene, so there's quite a lot more to say about it. First thing is Cassius and Brutus have their first of many long conversations in this play. Actually, let me back up. There was one thing I meant to talk about before I got into that. And that is, there's four themes. I meant to start with this. This was my opening material. There's four themes in this play that I have isolated. There's probably many more. But these are the ones that I find are the four big themes of the play. The first one is power versus impotence. I couldn't think of a better word. Maybe there's a better one, but I chose impotence.
Powerlessness.
Powerlessness. Or I was thinking inadequacy or something. Power versus no power. We'll see it played out. And then I have superstition versus reason. And then manhood I found to be a theme. You have a lot of different sort of types of men. And each sort of presents what they think manhood should be. And yeah, and so you get to see that kind of explored.
Tough guyness.
Yeah, a lot of
tough guy.
Yeah, and the fourth one is persuasion, honest versus manipulative. I don't know if any of you people are ret comp, but there's a lot of, I think a ret comp student would enjoy Julius Caesar. There's a lot of persuasion in here. So okay, moving along. Act 1, Scene 2, Cassius and Brutus have their first of many long conversations. And that's why what made me remember my four themes is because you've got these two different kinds of men constantly going up against each other in this play. And you kind of get to see what the characteristics of those men are. Also, in all of their conversations, the theme of ethical versus unethical persuasion strategies begins here. Brutus is speaking honestly, as in his lines in line 37 through 47. He says, "Be not deceived. If I have veiled my look, I turn the trouble of my countenance merely upon myself. Vexed I am of late with passions of some difference. Conceptions only proper to myself." And later on he says, you know, Then that poor Brutus, with himself at wars, forgets the shows of love to other men. You really do get the feeling that he's speaking from the heart. And then you've got Cassius. Cassius is clearly patronizing him and leading him on. And a clue to that, the first clue, I guess, you can see in his line, "Immortal Caesar," which is line 60 in my copy. I don't know if you've all got same numbers. He says, "I have heard where many of the best respect in Rome, except immortal Caesar," speaking of Brutus. Now, clearly we know that Cassius doesn't think much of Caesar, and so this is sarcasm. And later on, there's even more. And that comes, let's see, and I have also in line 136 through 62. Let me go there real quick to see what I'm talking about. Right. Cassius tantalizes Brutus by insinuating that Brutus could be emperor. That whole speech, he's kind of... everything that Cassius is saying, he's saying to get Brutus on his side. And he's sort of trying to arouse these kind of... the very kind of ambition that he's sort of angry at Caesar for. And he says, you know, in line 143 or 142, "But in ourselves... that we are underlings, Brutus and Caesar. What should be in that Caesar? Why should that name be sounded more than yours?" And it makes, if you were to take this as honesty, it'd be, yeah, Cassius really wants Brutus to be leader, but Cassius wants to be leader, you know. He certainly wants to be big and important, but he's making it sound like he's so selfless. Anyway, Cassius reveals his intentions in line 302. I'm kind of going to be jumping to lines like this through my whole little spiel here. Brutus leaves, and Cassius tells us what he's really thinking. You get this moment a lot in Shakespeare as well. Suddenly, the character is left alone with the audience, and he kind of discloses to you what he's really up to. You get that in Othello with a character named Iago, who is just... bad to the bone, but everybody thinks he's the greatest guy. But when he's alone, he kind of says to you, "Ooh, I'm so clever." And you've got that in, you know, Richard III and several other plays. In this play, it isn't quite clear that he's speaking to the audience, like Iago does, or Richard III. But this line, 306, is what does it for me. He says, "Therefore it is meet that noble minds keep ever with their likes, for who so firm that cannot be seduced?" That line, "seduced," makes it sound like he's getting a little bit too much pleasure out of the whole...
Out of manipulating Brutus.
Thank you. Yeah. It's just a little... he's a little too excited. And so it kind of reveals what he's really up to.
I just have one thing.
Go ahead,
please. To make
please.
It easy to follow this, everything Brutus does, Brutus is the noble conspirator who leads the assassination of Caesar. Mm-hmm. Everything he does is wrong. This guy cannot make a correct decision. Right? You meet people like this, you talk to them, they tell you who's going to win the election, you just bet the election. A guy like this in New Jersey, I mean, I just go on for an hour, everything is wrong. Some people
right.
just get it wrong. That's Brutus.
Well, and the layer on that is that he really means well. In fact, he means better than anyone else in this play. And so, anyway, I've not really anything else to say about Act 1, Scene 2, except for line 315 and 316. Now, remember I was talking about rhymed verse. Now, the last two lines of the scene... "And after this, let Caesar seat him sure, for we shall shake him, or worse days endure." The last two lines, you have a rhyming couplet here. That's another thing that Shakespeare does an awful lot. Now, he'll end a scene with a rhyming couplet. And it kind of gives this finality to it. It perks up your ears. It does a whole lot of different things. And and Shakespeare doesn't do it for every scene. I don't think that there's too many other scenes in this play where he does that. But he does it in every play, almost. So it's just something to look for when the rhyming couplet appears at the end of a scene. You know, like the rhyming couplet at the end of a sonnet or something. It also gives a
sense of fantasy. Mm. And here Cassius is so pleased that he's seduced Brutus. He goes into rhyme.
Right.
Ah, yes.
Just to sort of even punch up his cleverness, just to, in case you didn't notice. So, moving on, Act 1, Scene 3. A shorter scene. Kind of a normal-sized, I guess. After comparing Julius Caesar to a tyrannous tempest, Cassius assigns Cinna tasks that will hopefully win Brutus over to the conspiracy. So Cassius is still scheming. That's kind of the main thing going on here. The interesting thing about Act 1, Scene 3, and it kind of keeps going for a while, is that the storm begins. That's what really fascinates me. There's a storm here. And it will continue until the end of, I think, Act 2, Scene 2. And so the storm goes on for a while. Whenever it rains in Shakespeare, something is terrible is about to happen. And this, you know, in Othello, they all go out to war, and they come back real fast before anyone expected it. And it turns out what happened is this huge storm came and wiped all the enemy out. That's it. They didn't even have to fight. So they all come back victorious because a storm just killed everyone. And whenever it rains, there's just something going on. This storm is one of the most conspicuous storms in all of Shakespeare. You've got lions in the street and meteor showers. I mean, something is going very wrong here. And the storm continues for a while. And so you have to ask yourself, why does the storm begin here? Why does it end where it ends? I don't have the answers, but it's interesting.
Not unrelated to the essay for next week.
Aha.
Okay. This is not under, you know, back to Lewis and his impossibilities and everything else. And the theme is wonder. Why should I hide it? Wonder, the marvelous, the strange.
I'm going to write that.
What's being talked about there. So it's a good point. It's not so easy to figure out in isolation.
I'm going to just write that down real quick.
One of the things that goes on in Act 1 is another way of, Ed brings it out here when he says Cassius leads the conspiracy. But what you're watching through the whole act is the formation of the conspiracy. In Scene 1, you have these two guys, Morellus and Flavius, whose name, by the way, means black and white. Morellus is like the Morris, or the more, they're Latinate, they're dark, berry. And Flavius is blonde. They're generic characters. They're very unhappy, and they're trying to get things going, you know, by yelling at the plebeians, but that doesn't help. And then that doesn't get a conspiracy form, but you can see that they get, at least they get together, the two of them, by the end of the scene. And then in the second scene, you have Cassius working on Brutus, trying to see if there's an opportunity. And Brutus, you know, opens himself up to the conspiracy. And then in Scene 3, you get Casca brought in, and then by the end of the scene, suddenly three more people are in there, and you have seven conspirators. So if the time kind of gets speeded up, but the formation of that conspiracy and how difficult it is the subject of Act 1, which, you know, pretty much what he said there. But just
so that's Act 1. Act 2, despite the efforts of Portia and Calpurnia, their husbands leave home for the Senate, where their fates will be sealed. A second line of defense against the doomed day is established through the hopeful Artemidorus and soothsayer. So in Act 2, this is sort of a mini theme. Let's go right in, because I have this as a note. Act 2, Scene 1. In this scene and the next, we get a glimpse of the private lives of these two public figures. And so you get, there's a mini theme in this, versus the private and public life of a person, how we change our roles. And Shakespeare is frequently interested in what happens when a soldier becomes a politician. And you get that an awful lot. Or when, you know, when there's a Henry V, you know, He's this big, victorious, mighty king. But there's some prequel plays to Henry V where you see him as a boy. And you see him kind of having fun and kicking back and, you know, enjoying the perks of being the king's son. And Shakespeare seems to be real interested in how we change our roles and what happens when we grow and we make these kind of decisions. And he's particularly interested in when soldiers, people who are really used to fighting, become politicians, and he has them sort of doing the same kind of vicious fighting, but verbally, you know, in the public realm. Here, we've got what happens when politicians change roles again to become private citizens. I don't think it's a strong theme in the play, but it's there, and people talk about it. As the play shows, both men should have listened to their wives, but their priorities are focused on their public lives. That was a rhyming couplet. How about that? Anything on that? On Act 1, Act 2, Scene 1?
Yeah, let me, that's just one of the mistakes Bruce makes. Let me give you the first one because you'll never see it. The very second line. Here's Brutus. Here's our man. What, Lucius Ho? I cannot, by the progress of the stars, give guess how near today. In other words, one suspects that most people, could, I mean, I can do it. If you watch The Big Dipper, if you have any idea what time of year it is, you can have a pretty fair idea what time of day it is. 4 in the morning, it'll be aiming in a certain direction. And 2,000 years ago, people knew the stars really well. Now I can assume, and you can hear that Brutus is uneasy, that he is incapable of telling the time like everybody else. The guy's a loser. Okay. It's just a little thing. But Ed said he's, you know, this is a revolt of the upper classes here. Okay, something we tend to overlook. You mentioned it. It's often been overlooked, but it's one of the latest critical approaches to this riots to notice how that even in ancient Rome it was not a popular rebellion against Caesar. Caesar was a popular
guy. And in Elizabethan times, We kind of look at the conspirators in our time as very heroic, but they wouldn't have been looked on as such, I don't think, in Elizabethan England when monarchy was good. You know, that's, Caesar was trying to be king, you know.
It was a debatable topic.
It wasn't as quickly thought of as heroic because they were in a monarchy and monarchy is
actually,
good.
Actually, in the 15th century in Italy, the scholars would move from court to court and they would hold staged debates. It was a topic. Was Brutus a hero or a traitor? It was a normal debate topic. Okay, now for Shakespeare blurs it, but you know, Dante puts Brutus right down at the bottom of hell.
There you go.
Right? Now, we tend to look at him as the great, you know, a good guy. But then when we look at the play, he may be a good guy and well-intentioned, but he's tragic because he keeps making all these...
Well, and I've got a somewhat different reading of Brutus than you seem to. So I'll get to it later. It's not.
Do the mistakes in here?
Yeah. I'm interested.
I have a question then, because I don't know my history very well. So then, like in our times, we see Caesar as in fact being very ambitious and like he didn't deserve to die.
Well,
because in this play, I don't feel that. Like I feel like.
Well, he was trying to dissolve the republic. And he was trying to get it from a place where everybody gets a vote. It's a democracy to. I'm now the dictator for the rest of my life.
He was trying to...
Absolutely. Like, he was emperor.
Because the play portrays it more as like the people want this, right?
And well, like the people... We'll have a look at the people. That's a huge deal.
Yeah,
is what.
This is the end of the Roman Republic.
Yeah.
And when we like formed the United States, we didn't go back to Augustus Caesar. Right? We went back to the Republic and said, let's have a Senate. Mm-hmm. All right? Let's have these little votes, right or wrong. That's the American ethos has been that this was a bad thing.
That the empire was bad.
Let me just do the mistakes real quick.
Okay.
Line 10 is not really a mistake, but when Brutus says it must be by his death, we are interrupting his train of thought. I mean, he's been meditating. He seems to have weighed all the options, and right away he comes to this notion that Caesar has to be assassinated. Well, the result was desperately bad, so he's got to be, because it led to the Civil War, got to be wrong. Then they has this, when the conspirators get together, at line 115, Cassius says, let us swear our resolution. And Brutus says, no, not an oath. We don't need oaths. We're all sort of brothers here. He says, oaths are for women. Oaths are for priests, in line 130. It's a bad idea. I can't remember the play well enough, but you have to, because the conspirators break down. Right? They really did need the bonding, and he doesn't want it. Right? Then you get... They say, the next thing at line 140, well, we've got this conspiracy. Let's get Cicero in here. the greatest orator of Rome. He should be on our side. Brutus says, nope, don't need Cicero. I'll make all the speeches we need. And in his big speech after the assassination, he bombs. It's a horrible speech, and that's why Antony can get up and give the most famous speech in Shakespeare. You know, Caesar was an honorable man. No, Brutus is an honorable man. And just turns. So they needed Cicero. Brutus got it wrong. Right? Then the last thing, line 162, Cassius says, you know, if we're going to assassinate Caesar, you might as well assassinate his number two guy. Let's kill Antony. And Brutus says, No. Why bother? Then we'll look like butchers.
Well,
big mistake. Because Antony gives the big speech and leads the rebels.
Y'all should pay attention to the way I talk about. I don't pick on Brutus as much as Dr. Ross does.
Sorry.
I have a very different reading of Brutus, and we'll get to it. So you get to compare. His is probably right.
I'll shut up.
No. It's interesting. It provides a counterpoint. So that's Act 1. Act 2, Scene 1. Moving on. Act 2, Scene 2. Julius Caesar hears Calpurnia's foreboding dream and decides to stay at home for the day, when Decius reinterprets the dream, which changes Caesar's decision, and I forgot to have a period at the end of that sentence. That's rough. So Act 2, Scene 2, my notes. I find the reinterpretation of Caesar's dream fascinating. It foreshadows Act 3, Scene 2, where Caesar's murder will be reinterpreted by Antony in his speech. So both elements combined, the statement becomes that the plebeians in Act 3, Scene 2 are not swayed by Antony because they're stupid. It's not that they're the dumb masses. Because this scene shows that even Caesar is susceptible to that manipulative persuasion. And so here you've got that played out, that honest versus manipulative persuasion. And so this is just one man. It's not even a mob of people. But the reinterpretation of the event is all that Caesar needs to kind of change his mind. And he changes it pretty quick. He doesn't ask Decius any follow-up questions. He's with it. That's all I have for Act 2, Scene 2.
That just to...
Oh, no, it isn't, actually.
988 that you're talking about, right?
Right.
And Decius says, Calpurnia dreams Caesar was pouring blood like a fountain. And Decius says, no.
Right.
This is... You are... What does he say? That from you, great Rome shall suck reviving blood.
Also,
what kind of guy believes that, by the way?
he already wants to believe that he's invincible.
Yeah. When he talks about him...
It's manipulation, right? But it's flattery.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
Absolutely.
What's a form of manipulation?
Right.
Especially since Caesar said he wasn't...
Well, with Caesar, flattery gets you everywhere, you know? You'll find that Caesar talks about himself in the third person a lot. And as if he buys into his own legend, hook, line, and sinker.
If Caesar could fear, Caesar would fear this.
But, right.
You know, Ben Jonson, the Shakespeare contemporary, said that was the stupidest line he ever heard. You know, he said, oh, that's Shakespeare. He doesn't know how to write.
What line is
but
that?
But that was the idea. If Caesar
it's
could,
earlier.
If,
oh,
if
yeah,
Caesar
yeah.
could fear... There's a similar one at line 45 here, where the end is talking about danger knows full well that Caesar is more dangerous than he. Danger, Caesar, two lions. He said, we're like two lions. Okay, very pompous. He's a very pompous guy.
The last thing about Act 2, Scene 2, on Caesar's line 115, Caesar says, what is the clock? Brutus says, Caesar, 'tis struck an eight. Caesar says, I thank you for your pains and courtesy. Shakespeare can never resist a good pun. He even in the most totally inappropriate and unlikely sort of moments. The pun is pains. Brutus hears this and is thinking, oh my God, he knows. You know, because pain is you went to the trouble, but it's also hack, 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 you know?
I mean, you're saying Caesar's foreseeing his...
No, I'm saying Shakespeare is inserting the pun for the audience. Who knows what's going to happen? Everybody knows Caesar's dead, that Caesar's going to get killed.
Not about that one, Ed.
No? Okay. Well, be that as it may, Shakespeare cannot resist a pun.
I like the next line, though. See Antony that revels long a night. This is the same Antony in Antony and Cleopatra. Mr. Party Animal. Okay. Up all night with Cleopatra. Loves a good banquet. And Shakespeare has this ability to carry characters from one play to the next. We don't see Antony partying in Julius Caesar, but the character's set. Right? So you can read the Roman plays together.
Sure. So that's it for Act 2, Scene 2. Act 2, Scene 3. Artemidorus plans to discreetly warn Julius Caesar with a cautionary letter. I have nothing really to say about this scene except that it's definitely there to heighten the dramatic tension. In case you thought things were going real, real well for the conspirators, here's something that could keep them from getting what they wanted, and it sort of just tightens things up a little.
How does Artemidorus know that there's a conspiracy?
That's a good question. He knows who's involved.
Yeah.
Hadn't thought of it.
Either he's magic, and he's foreselling the future, or somebody talked. Now, as far as we've seen, who's likely to talk? I think you know my answer.
You're going
to
say Brutus.
Who did he tell?
His wife.
He told his wife. But she, at the end of the scene, says, as much as it this is really hurts, but I'm managing not to tell anybody. All right, that's what she said. She can hardly restrain herself from blurting out the conspiracy. So that means, or it raises the possibility that Brutus has told somebody else, and it's gotten out. Maybe it's that little kid who carries the torch for him.
Lucius.
Brutus has got problems.
I don't think he would blab. I don't, because he's, before anything, he would think it dishonest. I think, and dishonorable to blab.
No, but he's so honorable.
So trusting.
That his cause is noble.
He can't think anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't comprehend that people would disagree with him.
Well, there's not a lot in the text to suggest that Brutus blabbed to Artemidorus.
It's an extrapolation.
Right. It's with Shakespeare, you really have to kind of stick to the text. You can't. It's kind of dangerous to do that. I don't do it anyway. Moving on. Act 2, Scene 4, Portia, Brutus's wife, is so worried about Brutus that she sends a servant to go observe him. Her words are strengthened by the soothsayer's premonition. Again, I don't have a lot to say about this scene. It's just more to heighten that dramatic tension. In case you thought things were going way too well for the conspirators, there's, like I say in my summary of Act 2, it's kind of the second line of defense against the doomed day. Even though as an audience member back then, as well as now, you know that they're going to murdered Caesar, and that they're going to get away with it, they just throw some tension in there. So you got to wonder how it's going to play out. It's no longer as smooth as ice because of these last two scenes. And so you have this balance of Act 2. In the first two scenes, things are kind of moving forward, and in the last two scenes, things seem to move backward against the progress of the play. And so,
but the conspiracy moves forward.
Not in the last two scenes. In the last two scenes, you see some defenses established against the conspiracy. People are really determined to stop it. And it doesn't actually move backward, but the tension is established there. You know what I mean?
I'm just trying to reconcile that with the normal pattern of the first three acts that sort of rising action. You know? Everything moves in the same direction, but I suppose you could argue everything's moving downhill.
Right, yeah. Well, people, everybody's starting to freak out.
Conspiracy for right. It, but it's a weird conspiracy.
And there are already some enemies, you know, against the conspiracy. So, moving on, Act 3. The murder of Julius Caesar goes as planned, but Antony poisons the public against the conspirators, again, forgot a period. So Act 3, Scene 1 is kind of a big one. The conspirators murder Julius Caesar. Brutus allows Antony to prepare a eulogy despite Cassius's warning. Antony begins to plot against the conspirators. The fate of Publius Cimber seems to be the conspirators' final test of Caesar's sense of justice. They don't just kill him. They ask him real quick about this political issue. And I think that that's really interesting that they do that, because they're bent on murdering him. They're gonna do it. But just in case they weren't sure or something, they ask him what the fate of this guy is, who you don't ever really hear from in the play, or really know anything about him, but they make sure just one last time that he really is the jerk they think he is. So it's really just red tape, talking about Publius Cimber at the beginning. And
well, it confirms them that they're right.
Right.
That Caesar's a jerk.
But the point is they...
This is the guy's brother. They're asking for his pardon.
Right.
And Caesar's saying no.
But it seems to me that even if he said, yes, he's pardoned, they still would have murdered him. It's it's like they needed to justify it to themselves. Yeah, okay, we're justified in this. See, he really is a tyrant. Just one last test. They've been with him for years. They know that he's, you know.
You think it's a test, or they know what the answer is going to be?
Exactly. They totally knew. And so they just, you know, it's almost like in Hamlet. Hamlet does not kill the name just... Claudius when he's at prayer, because it's not right to kill him at prayer. So they set Caesar up to kill him as he's being a tyrant. And the most justified sort of position to kill a guy is when he's being totally evil, you know? And so maybe that's it. Anyway.
Well, isn't this...
Go ahead.
It's an interesting question. I used to have a line on this. I can't remember it. But it's really the function is to allow them all to get close to Caesar.
Mm-hmm.
That they can all beg for this guy. And since it's a topic that's come up before, Caesar seems to be used to them complaining that he's being very hard on this guy. So he's not suspicious when they move in close. Right.
Yeah, no, I mean that...
I was thinking about that too, but there's also the line where he says, stick close to me. Like, he already wants him close.
You mean Caesar wants him?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. There's a line he says, stick close to me, and then someone says, closer than you're going to be happy.
Okay.
Yeah,
it's a tough one. How about that line 8? Artemidorus gets in there, right? With the paper that would tell Caesar that there's a conspiracy.
Right.
And Caesar won't read it. Why not? He says, what touches us ourselves shall be last served. It's his pride. But it's a bad decision, isn't it? I mean, if he read it.
Definitely. Well, it's a fatal decision.
Right. So he regards this as his good quality coming to the fore. Caesar puts himself last when he's publicly, and he pays for it, which makes him a tragic figure in my book, when you're trying to do the right thing.
Right. That's how I read Brutus, by the way. We'll get to it.
He's always trying to do the right thing. I'm just saying he always doesn't.
I'll get to it. I have just a slightly different take on it.
I don't know guys like that.
I love how Jersey is this microcosm of the world. We see the same event occur. I'm back on the Publius thing. We see the same event occur in Act 4, Scene 1, when this guy Publius's fate is decided again, this time by Antony. In Act 4, Scene 1, Antony and Octavius are sitting there deciding, and Lepidus, they're sitting there deciding who their friends are and who their enemies are, and they discuss Publius again. And Antony does the same thing. He passes judgment on Publius without Publius being there to defend himself. And so there's a mirror for it. And that pleases me, that it happens again, and there's a pattern there, that you can see Antony sort of pass the same judgment that Caesar did. And so it's this kind of meet the new boss, same as the old boss thing, which again, Shakespeare does all the time, all through his history plays. It's the same jerk on the throne with a different name.
So the point is, murdering Caesar didn't solve the problem
right.
of Caesar's power.
And right.
That's why Brutus was wrong right from the beginning. It must be by his murder. Sorry.
So, yeah. And we'll talk about that a lot more. Cassius and Brutus' conversation in line 237 through 243.
This is
Act 3, Scene 1. 237. Let me get there myself. Through 243. This is where my reading of Brutus starts. I read Brutus as a radical thinker. He dreams of the way the world should be. He, like we said, all of his intentions are good, and they're so good that they're too good. He doesn't exist in the real world. And what Shakespeare does, I think, in all of his tragedies, especially, is he sort of projects this possible world that we aren't even at yet. It's like he's seeing into this future that we could have for ourselves, you know? And you know, Brutus lives in that world, and the world that Brutus lives in won't have it. And that's, I think, the source of Shakespeare's tragedy, is when someone wants to exist in this better world, but they can't. That's my reading of Brutus. And so it's slightly different.
He's an idealist. And
yeah.
The things he does in this world.
I kind of look at him somewhat heroically, and not like a schlub. That's the big difference.
Does he recognize that this world is not possible? Or when does he recognize?
He never does. The world kills him. Well,
to me, that sounds like there's a difference. I mean, maybe he's heroic in a sense, but he doesn't understand. He's really short-sighted.
Well, and he doesn't even see the world. He really lives. His whole worldview is this totally different perspective. And you see that in his conversation here with Cassius and with Cassius. Cassius keeps trying to sort of bring Brutus down from the clouds. All throughout the play, he's trying to be like, you've got to see your nose for your face, Brutus. But he never does. And a lot of people interpret that as naive, that Brutus is very naive and maybe dumb. And there is a little of that. He's not... But really, I viewed his naivete as sort of this radical kind of thinking that doesn't exist. None of these other guys in this play think the way Brutus does.
Which line is giving you that?
Let's see, 237.
I will myself.
Well, he seems to think, he says, what Antony shall speak, I will protest. He speaks by leave and by permission, and that we are contented. Caesar shall have all true rights and lawful ceremonies. It shall advantage more than do us wrong. He just seems to think that everybody's going to work like he does. He says, this is going to be great. I'm going to, you know, be real honest with everybody. And, you know, he lives in this world where truth and justice and honor are always going to win the day. That's how it should be.
Why is he going to protest that they're just allowing... You're saying he...
Well, what Antony shall speak, I will protest. He speaks by leave and permission. And so he
knows he's going to say something.
Right.
Trouble.
So, well, he doesn't exactly even know what he's going to say, but
he knows Antony's going to make trouble.
He thinks that if he tells the people that he, you know, I'm Brutus and I've approved this message, and then Antony can go up and whatever he's going to say is great. That the people...
No, I think he wants the people to see him as a balanced person, a thoughtful person. Right? About counter-arguments. We killed him. There's some arguments that he shouldn't have died.
Yeah.
Go ahead. You can listen to them. We'll look at both sides of the issue.
Right.
We'll get two talking heads.
And so,
out here.
And Brutus lives in this world.
And he hopes that that
where the people are going to consider it.
The people and, love
and they're going to.
Because he's so fair.
Yeah.
He listens to the other side.
Because that's what you should love a fair leader.
And Cassius goes, are you out of your mind?
Right. Yeah. And so, but. So that's Act 3, Scene 1. Act 3, Scene 2. Brutus defends the murder in his public speech, but foolishly leaves Antony unsupervised to give his eulogy. Antony uses clever rhetoric to move the people to mutiny against the conspirators, and news arrives of Octavius's return to Rome. Like in Act 1, Scene 1, we've got Brutus's speech in prose and Antony's speech in blank verse. And this is, both noblemen. They're both in the same class, but they're using different tactics. And I'm not exactly sure what to make of it, but you can't ignore it, is one thing that's sure. The prose versus the verse.
Well, just taking what you said in scene one, whose speech is going to be better?
Right, Antony's.
Because it's in verse.
It's just more heightened.
How bad is Brutus's speech?
It's kind of common sounding and
I only have two things to say. He starts with a normal, simple ethical appeal. I'm Brutus, I'm honorable, you should believe me. In other words, he doesn't have any good arguments. He stands up there, but I'm a good guy, what I do is what is good, must be good, because I'm a good guy. And that's a very powerful rhetorical, thing.
He's setting up his ethos.
But logically, it doesn't get you anywhere, if you look at it. And then the style, the rhetorical style, he uses very simple parallel structures. So you can look and see at the end, particularly, who is here so rude, if any, speak. Who is here so vile, if any, speak. Blah, blah. Just simple parallel.
Right.
In this case, simple style, simple thought.
In line... Oh, was that it?
This goes against my other things I'm doing.
go ahead. In line 46, the third plebeian says, "Let him be Caesar." And actually, my book here has an awesome note about this line. The note says, "In this passing exclamation, Shakespeare records the futility of the conspiracy. The plebeians, as a kind of course, express the collective political wisdom, or lack of it, in Rome. From their point of view, Caesar's death has changed nothing." And so, they just want a new ruler. Oh, great. They've totally missed the point, somehow. I think that's a really valuable line there. Let him be a Caesar. So on to Antony's famous, famous speech. Any people who know absolutely nothing about Shakespeare know this first line: "Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears." Again, in blank verse, heavily, utterly conspicuous repetitions of the word ambitious and honorable. And if you say a word enough times, we've all done this, the meaning of it just starts to drip away. And he doesn't ever, at least at this point, he doesn't ever come out and say what he's talking about. He just allows the meaning to drip away as he keeps on repeating honorable, honorable. And it just, the people do the work for him. They reinterpret it without him having to tell them to.
So it becomes ironic.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
It starts to mean the opposite of what he's saying. Brutus is not honorable, and Caesar was not ambitious.
I'm not going to say too terribly much more about his speech, except for in line 140, he finally says something that I find interesting. In rhetoric, I haven't really had much experience with rhetoric until this year, and one thing I've learned about rhetoric is that sometimes you anticipate your audience, and you figure out what they're going to want to hear. Other times you create your audience and you create values in them that they may not have either had or may not realize that they have had. And here in line 140 he says, "It will inflame you. It will make you mad." He tells them that they're going to be mad. And he kind of creates his audience in that way. which is, you know, directly opposite to what Brutus does. Brutus says, just come on, people, you know, go with me here. And Antony straight up tells them exactly how to react. And they do it.
It is very, the next line straight is also rhetorical. It's called occupatio. You know,
what line?
141.
You know not that you are his heirs. I'm too busy to tell you certain things.
141.
Five.
Act 3, scene 2.
You know not that you are his heirs.
141. Right after my line, it will inflame you, it will make you mad. Right. He kind of does this reverse psychology on them. He's like, you'd really like to hear it, but I'm not going to tell you. Oh, no, no, no.
It's called I'm occupied.
Occupatio. I love all those little names. That's pretty much all I've got on Act 3, Scene 2. If anybody has anything else. If not, we're going to move right on to Act 3, Scene 3.
Yeah, let me just one.
Go ahead.
He maintains his irony pretty well, straight up. When I analyze this, right up the line in my book, 189. Actually, I'm writing a book with you on this topic, so to remind myself this is here. somebody's written a book on treason. The line is, whilst bloody treason flourished over us. Did you see that line?
187 in my book.
Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen. Then I and you and all of us fell down whilst bloody treason flourished over us. But, I mean, that's a shift. He's not lying. He's not ironic. He's not occupied. He's calling the murder treason. So the speech, which is long and in five parts, you can go into breaks here.
Right.
And he'd been phony kind of before, but and it's really kind of right in the middle of the speech, too.
Well, and it's definitely after he realizes that everybody's with him. Yeah. All the plebeians are totally on board, especially when they hear that they're going to get something out of it from Caesar's will. And the notes that I have do they adjusted for inflation, like the drachmas that he's going to get, and it's like $100 per Roman, like they're all going to get $100 from Caesar's will, and they're very excited about that.
Yeah, well, you know, we all got $600. You guys get $600? You were too young.
From what?
The first thing the Republicans did in 2000 was give everybody a tax rebate. $600. Remember that?
Yeah.
As crass a move as you can imagine. Yeah. Here, have $600. You know how long that lasted. No, they didn't. They got the check.
Well, we didn't get no check.
No, this is for the average guy, because they weren't cutting the average person's taxes, despite what they said. What they do is they cut our income tax, they raise our Social Security. It's been going on since Reagan. When do you start making money? You can't believe it. And taxes always go up, no matter what they say, because they just pop it into the Social Security column.
Act 3, scene 3.
My brother says to me, are you still... You know, the cutoff is like a certain number. He says, you mean you're not even making enough not to pay Social Security? I love that. Nope.
Act 3, scene 3. The plebeians harass and abduct Cinna the poet, even though they know he is not Cinna the conspirator. And whether or not they really get it, he at least tries to tell them, but they don't get it or they don't care. We're going to talk about it when we get to the criticism, though. One of our critics has something really, really cool to say about it, so we'll get to it later. So I'm going to.
He's a conspirator, right?
Huh? No, Cinna the poet is just a poet. He's not a conspirator. There's two Cinnas in this play: Cinna the conspirator, Cinna the poet.
So this is the big shift, too. Everything's sort of going okay. But this is like the first moment of terror.
Right.
And it's right, just like Antony's ship when he starts using the word treason and traitor. Here, they clearly unleash civil war. this is your first sign.
So, Act 4. There is weakness and double dealing on both sides, but both parties are ready to fight. See, there's... couldn't really extract one action out of it, but that's
well,
about as...
Act has disappeared.
Yeah. So that's my summary of Act 4. Act 4, Scene 1. Though Antony, Octavius, and Lepidus discussed who their friends are and enemies are, Antony discloses to Octavius that Lepidus will eventually be phased out. And here again, you'll see they discuss the fate of poor Publius, or Publius, or in those first few lines. And so that I don't really have too terribly much to say about this scene, except for something that's interesting at the end. We've been talking a lot about meter in our other class with Dr. Ross. So I thought I'd call to your attention the final line in Act 4, Scene 1. Octavius says, "And some that smile have in their hearts, I fear, millions of mischief." And there's a break in the meter here. First off, he doesn't finish the iambic pentameter. And second off, no one says millions. So the iambic pentameter makes it starts with unaccented and goes to accented. Like in the line before it, "and some," you see how that goes? So like the "and" is unaccented. He goes, "and some that smile have in their hearts, I fear." Real regular meter there. The next one should go, "millions of mischief," but it doesn't.
Well, except for the first foot.
Okay. Go ahead.
You can have an inversion in the first two syllables. It's a very common thing to put the accent on the first syllable and then on the unstressed second, unstressed third, and then stressed fourth. I was miserable at explaining this to my class. Okay. Whenever they put the accent on the first syllable, they would then put it on the third, fifth, seventh. Okay. So it goes, in this case, it would go millions. Well, this one's bad. This is actually good. You're right, it's a break in the meter. Okay, so there's no doubt about that. But if it had been iambic pentameter, it would be okay to have an accent on the first syllable. Let me find the line.
So basically, the idea is when there's a break in the meter,
right.
There's like a big flashing light saying, pay attention to this. And he's making a huge point here. Some that smile have in their hearts, I fear, millions of mischief. That's a big deal. So that's really all I have to say about that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I would mark that to meditate on, because you're absolutely right. This is Octavius. This is the guy who's going to be
Augustus
Caesar. And he's brutal in Shakespeare's depiction. He's a cold-hearted bastard. So, not even finishing the line, you just sort of make up reasons for it. It just shows he's really meditating, he's completely in control, he's purposely thinking about this because he's going to be so ruthless against these people who have mischief in their heart. Millions of mischief, he hates them, right? He's ruthless. And this is just the end of Act 4, Scene 1.
Yeah, that's Act 4, Scene 1. Act 4, Scene 2. Brutus is nervous about the coming days, and to make matters worse, Cassius arrives only to accuse Brutus of some wrongdoing. They withdraw to discuss it privately. Again, so this is Brutus's insistence on the way things should be, I find here is kind of pronounced. In line 41, Cassius is ready to go. Cassius cannot wait to jump down Brutus's throat. He is pissed off. Brutus is kind of somewhat cool as a cucumber, but he's thinking of the troops. In line 41, he, "Before the eyes of both our armies here, which should perceive nothing but love from us, let us not wrangle. Bid them move away. Then in my tent, Cassius, enlarge your griefs, and I will give you audience." He and as we'll find out, Brutus has some grievances against Cassius. You don't know it yet, but he could very well have been ready to jump down Cassius's throat. But he isn't. He's thinking of the troops and their morale, which Cassius hadn't even thought of, you know? And so it's just this kind of, he's so concerned about everybody's feelings, you know? That's all I have to say about that scene.
Well, they're arguing about one of Cassius's soldiers was taking bribes or something, right?
Not yet.
That's
in the next scene.
Oh, okay.
So, is that it for that scene?
This is Act
4, Act 4, Scene 2.
Well, does he make any...
He doesn't make any accusations.
Does he make any decisions that might be wrong? How about line 248? 248. Do you have this broken into another scene?
Yes.
Okay, so that's fine.
My act three end, or my scene three ends, Brutus says, Lucius, do you the like, and let no man come to our tent till we have done our conference. Let Lucilius and Titinius guard our door. That's a line 50. For me. Someone else has it. Well, that's where my scene three, or my scene two ends.
Okay. You're breaking it into two
scenes.
Okay, go ahead.
So act four, scene three begins. My little summary here. Brutus counter-accuses Cassius, and they argue at length. Brutus confesses that Portia has committed suicide. Brutus and Cassius make amends. Everyone leaves, and Caesar's ghost threatens Brutus in a dream, or perhaps in reality. I shouldn't have written that. Frightened, Brutus wakes everyone up and urges an earlier strike against Antony Octavius than previously planned. So it's a big scene, and as such, there's a lot to say about it. This argument is the big famous argument between Brutus and Cassius. Brutus again kind of argues for how things should be, and Cassius argues for practicality, or the real world, especially in my line 30. He says, Brutus is just, you know, he says in line 18, remember the Ides of March, did not great Julius bleed for justice sake? You know, he's kind of like, oh, come on, man, we're talking about justice here. Really sort of, you know... And he says, I had rather be a dog and bay at the moon than such a Roman, in line 28. Cassius responds with, Brutus, bait me not, I'll not endure it, you forget yourself. To hedge me in, I am a soldier, I older in practice, abler than yourself to make conditions. He's saying, look, I've been out in the, you don't know what you're talking about, I do. So it's really this sort of, you've got practicality arguing with sort of a radical thinking, hypothetical.
When your allies are all taking bribes.
Right. Well, and Cassius is just like, Cassius is saying, this is the way that it goes. We need these people. They're only available by bribe. This is going to help us win. Brutus says, oh no, that's all for, this is, we're look at us, look at what we've become. And, of course, as Ross would remind you, he is making the wrong decision.
Yeah, he's sort of like 60 Minutes last week, worrying about, you know, we lost $800 million in Iraq. Just sort of disappeared.
Right.
That's right.
So, in my line, I hate it that we have different...
Let's get that 50 lines.
Okay. Well, in my line 65... 115 for everybody else. They start to resolve the argument here. Brutus makes his counter argument. He says, you know, I'm pissed at you too because you have denied. I sent for this money. You didn't give me the money. What the hell is going on here? And Cassius, kind of, this is not what we might have predicted. He says, I denied you not. He denies it. He denies the accusation. Brutus says, you did. And he says, I did not. He was but a fool that brought my answer back. Brutus has rived my heart. And so...
Rived.
Excuse me. He's probably lying. But again, there's nothing in the text to suggest that he's lying, except for the fact that Cassius can only speak to Brutus manipulatively. He can only say what he knows Brutus wants to hear.
Well, he may not be...
Who knows?
He expected his messenger to do a much better job of explaining why the money wasn't coming.
Right.
Okay. In other words, such a good job that it would look like the truth. By the way, why does Brutus need money?
His troops.
Yeah, to pay them.
But why is he incapable of getting
the people of Rome are against him?
No. Oh, okay. I got it. There in line 71, he says, "For I can raise no money by vile means. By heaven, I had rather coin my heart and drop my blood for drachmas than to wring from the hard hands of peasants their vile trash by any direction. I did send to you to do it."
Right. He's Mr. Nice Guy.
Yeah.
No taxes.
But he has no problem with asking Cassius to go do some dirty work.
No taxes. He's a terrible politician.
So, he
doesn't know how to raise the Social Security taxes at the same time.
So,
and the property taxes, you don't notice.
Yeah, but he's not a politician in any sense. I mean, he doesn't know how to talk to the people.
Well, he is a politician in the sense that he's part of this conspiracy, if not kind of the leader of it once he gets on board. And he's the person that everybody kind of looks to. So he does have to... He's not a good politician.
he's a good politician.
Well, he's the ideal politician.
Yeah.
But again, the tragic push of the play says that ideal politicians won't work. So the argument is basically over by line 86. Cassius denies it. He says, "You're breaking my heart here, Brutus." You know, they kind of have a little bit of, you know, "You love me not, Brutus. Well, I don't like you." You know, "I don't like it when you're a jerk like that." And they kind of do this little makeup thing. And it is the first time in the battle that they're in this big war, that a misunderstanding between Cassius and Brutus occurs. But it certainly isn't the last. What starts to happen here, and this is also a bit of a mini theme, is just people not getting the message. And how misunderstandings can be fatal, and how communication is the way that we kind of support each other and keep each other alive as a species. And when it goes badly, this is what happens. Later on, Cassius not getting Brutus's message is going to be fatal. However, for now, in line 163, again, Act 4, Scene 3. Well, back up a little. Brutus tells Cassius that Portia has died, that she's committed suicide, and they commiserated about it for a while, but Brutus says, "I don't want to talk about it. We've got stuff to do." And then Lucius comes in, and they start talking about business. Let's talk about planning this war, and they're talking about it, and then in that line, 163, Cassius says, "Portia, art thou gone?" And... Cassius recalling Portia is strange. Everyone else has moved on to pressing new business, but Cassius remains fixated. The news of Portia's death has shaken Cassius, and it seems to briefly disarm him. You don't get a lot of Cassius emotion in the earlier parts of this play, but he's starting to kind of... Something's going on with Cassius. He kind of starts to change. And this seems to be the first big blow to Cassius.
He knows he's dealing with an idiot. And then
Brutus and Lucius have a kind of a private moment in line 238 to 273, but we'll talk about it a little later in the criticism. Finally, it is odd and noteworthy that Caesar's ghost, when he appears to Brutus... In my line, about 274, that's when Caesar's ghost appears, which is just bizarre. Again, when that kind of stuff starts happening, you know something is just bad. That's a huge hey you sign, you know, for things aren't going well. But Brutus asks who he is, or what he is, and the ghost replies, "Thy evil spirit, Brutus." And that can be taken a few ways. The first way is just, I'm here to bug you. You know, I'm the evil spirit that's going to bother you. Or that he's kind of this manifestation of Brutus's evilness. He says, I'm your evil spirit. And so I'm not sure how to take it, but it's definitely there.
Evilness. I mean, that's absolutely right. That, you know, it's a projection of Brutus,
right,
rather than an external Caesar. Because it's what aspect? Well, everybody's got sort of two angels.
Mm-hmm.
The good one and the bad one. Jiminy Cricket going, Pinocchio, go to school. And then the bad one. So I don't know if evil is quite the right word.
Right.
It's his bad spirit, the one who gives
it's the word that the ghost
advice.
Uses. Which
yeah,
is
yeah, I know. I'm just trying to
yeah,
answer
yeah.
your
evil is always a little too hoo-ha,
right.
You know. It's
what you're saying was
yeah. The word evil is a little too D. I think that the exchange between Brutus and the ghost is just bizarre. He says, when shall I see thee again? The ghost says, I, at Philippi. And then Brutus says, well, I'll see you then. Which I think is a strange... because he's shaken when the ghost appears. Earlier on, he says, you know, art thou some god, some angel, or some devil that makes my blood cold and my hair to stare? He's clearly shaken by it. But then, as the conversation goes, he kind of dismisses the ghost. You know, when am I going to see you again? The ghost tells him when. He says, all right, it's a deal. I'll see you then. Bye. And the ghost vanishes. So, that's that. That's Act 4. Act 5.
Let me just say
okay.
One thing I want to say. Oh, yeah. How did Portia die?
This is good. I'm glad you... I wasn't going to talk about it, but I'll go ahead and talk about it since you asked it. They said she swallows fire. And that's a... You know, I was trying to picture that. How are you going to swallow fire? In Plutarch... Shakespeare gets all of his material, most of his material, for this play and many of his other plays from Plutarch. And just from a lot of really famous histories. In the history, Portia is said to have... there's one version that says she put burning hot coals in her mouth and kind of held her mouth until it killed her. And another one says that she just swallowed them. She just put a bunch of hot coals and swallowed them. And so when they say she swallowed fire, it's odd that they wouldn't have been, that Shakespeare wouldn't have gone with that terribly gory image. But that's the history. That's what
right.
Plutarch says.
What does it tell us about her, though, that she did that? Okay. What kind of... It's almost a biblical image from Jeremiah with the hot coals on the tongue.
What did you say, Dave?
She talked.
Oh, I see. Oh.
Burning her mouth.
There's your Artemidorus theory.
Yeah. Or, but she hadn't done it yet. That's the problem.
Right, yeah.
Or she said she had. But earlier in that scene in 2 Scene 4, and I couldn't find the line right now, but she was very frantic, okay? And another way of looking at this fire is that she went mad.
Right.
And she'd been very frantic, and you can see her sort of going off the deep end. But she'd also stabbed herself earlier. She'd actually... wounded herself in her thigh. So she'd already been like cutting herself and prone to suicidal gestures, right? And again, I don't want to put things into the play that aren't there, but it makes for a very interesting wife.
And interesting.
You have to ask, I mean, and you have to assume, you could assume in a realistic production of this, that Brutus would have known who he was married to. And yet he still told her. Plus Brutus is going to commit suicide himself.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not unlikely that they're two of a kind. And so projecting Caesar's ghost, he's really starting his own madness that will lead to his suicide. Because his suicide is very unmotivated otherwise. It really mm-hmm. comes right from himself,
right.
Not from external events. Right? So they're really a wonderful couple.
To some extent, well, we'll get to Brutus's suicide.
You know, the movies don't touch this at all.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I mean, a really great modern production with a lot of, you know, weird people in it. This would be a great part.
One as such, Brutus is often described as being, you know, one of Shakespeare's first real, like, heavily psychological characters, or if not the first, just one of these kind of very psychologically deep characters, which wasn't something that playwrights did back then. You know, you have, I don't know, the Bacchae, you know, which is way going way back, of course, but those characters aren't real deep psychological torn. And so, anyway.
Can we take a break?
Oh, okay.
Just people might need a break now. I'll start the tape again just in case.
Great.
In case we've lost it. Come on,
It's still ticking. It seems to be counting down. Oh, remaining, it says.
I have no idea what that means.